Thank you for joining us for the Preceptor Podcast. I'm Sarah.
I'm Ryan, and today we have with us a returning guest, Dr. Mike Fabro. Mike, you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I used to be on faculty here until I supposedly retired, but I find myself still involved in part-time teaching for here in the University of Cincinnati. And I had a cardiology interest my entire 40-year career in academia and try to keep up with everything, even today. As things change, and they rapidly do change in cardiology.
Somebody once told me that good pharmacists never actually retire, and I think that's true.
Well, good, then I won't retire.
So we asked Mike here a little bit to talk about aspirin and its use in primary prevention. I know that this is a really hot button topic right now, and lots of things are coming out, lots of changes. But just to start, can you kind of give us a history of aspirin and its use in primary prevention?
Yeah. Obviously, 30, 40, 50 years ago, the best documented benefit for aspirin were these large post-MI trials where patients with known existing coronary disease and even a recent acute coronary syndrome treated with aspirin. And we used to use a lot bigger doses of aspirin back then than we do now. That's been an evolution over time as well. Prevented recurrent events and prevented cardiovascular death and even total mortality. Typically in the range of 15 to 20%, depending on which study that you looked at. And so the logical extension then evolved into giving aspirin to patients who didn't have a recent MI, but still had known coronary disease. They had angina, they've been got a stent, and that's been shown to reduce your chance for your first MI if you identify those people and then put them on aspirin. And so then I guess the next logical extension was to take people who are at high enough risk for an event, then maybe we know the role that platelets play in platelet aggregation and plaque rupture and clot formation in acute coronary syndromes. If you're at high enough risk, having never been shown to have atherosclerosis or MI, you probably benefit from aspirin as well. And so there was not a lot of data on the magnitude of the primary prevention benefit, but it was just sort of a logical extension.
Makes sense. I mean, the aspirin's really cheap, and if you can, the cost-benefit ratio is really good there if you actually are making that difference.
Sure. Although I would say that the risk of being on aspirin, even as we start evolving into the lower baby aspirin doses, which is very, very, very little reason to ever use more than that, it's still not innocuous, and I think that gets under-recognized, and it sort of gets at the heart of what the recent recommendations is because of recognition of this small but still clinically important risk for being on aspirin from a bleeding perspective.
Yeah, so you're referencing the next question I have for you really.
Okay.
Well. So things are constantly evolving in medicine, but what has changed recently in regard to aspirin for primary prevention?
Yeah, there's a... something called the U.S. Preventative Task Force, which is an independent group. It's not part of the federal government, although they were funded by the federal government to complete this new guideline for recommendation for aspirin, which I read the whole thing. I'm a recognized drug dork. It's 230 pages long. So if you do get it, I would recommend reading the executive summary rather than the entire, but it's very thorough in their evaluation of every recent aspirin trial since 2014 in primary prevention. And basically, you see about a 10% reduction in non-fatal MI, a little bit better reduction than that in non-fatal stroke, like 18%, I think it was, and no benefit in cardiovascular death, no benefit in total mortality. And so you mostly are preventing, now I don't want to downplay preventing a non-fatal stroke, that's sort of a good thing to prevent, but at the risk of causing intracranial bleeds and major GI bleeds, often requiring hospitalization, to the point where it's about equal, sort of across the board. And the reason probably that it's recommended not for routine primary prevention use is that the better we manage typical other treatable risk factors, smoking cessation, aggressive lipid management, blood pressure control, diabetes, which we're better able to manage now than we ever were, the role of aspirin in a primary setting is pretty much almost non-existent. So the focus should be on those things. Now, they hedge their bets in the guideline a little bit and say, is there a point in time at which your risk might become high enough due to multiple poorly controlled risk factors that the risk of bleeds might be worth taking to get some benefit from aspirin? And the answer is probably yes. We just don't know exactly where that would be. But clearly, one of the biggest bleed risk factors is age. If you get above 70 in particular, it's when the bleeds start taking off.
Okay. I did not realize that. So as we're thinking about pharmacists in our practice settings, for an ambulatory care pharmacist that's, you know, seeing patients, I know a lot of our ambulatory care patients are diabetes patients in this area. What would you recommend for them? Should they be starting people primary prevention for aspirin at this point? Should they be continuing it? If they're on, should they be stopping? What does this say?
All of those are relevant questions. I've read a couple editorials about this report when it came out. And one was by a cardiologist who specialized in epidemiology, and his statement was, we should just give up aspirin totally in this primary prevention setting and go after other risk factors and stop it in people, which we know there's momentum to have difficulty in doing that, particularly if they seem to have well tolerated for a year or years, but it probably shouldn't stop. Because remember, you know, when you talk about the annual bleed risk from being on aspirin, it's not like if you're on it for a year, you have no bleed risk the next year. That bleed risk is still there for the next year, and it's still there for the next year with questionable long-term benefit in the absence of known coronary disease. So I've seen commentaries where people said that we should look for people to stop it.
Okay.
And certainly not stop it. And I should say, you mentioned diabetes. You know, one of the big trials that was conducted that led to part of this report's conclusion was thinking diabetes as a risk factor is probably significant enough that you would benefit from being on aspirin, whether you had no known coronary disease or not. And that trial basically showed a small reduction but a big bleed risk, and so they don't recommend it just because you have diabetes. And that would have been contrary to what we would have thought even 5 years ago.
Just to follow up, when you talk about bleed risk, is it similar for the 81 milligrams and the 325? Is there a difference there?
There is a little difference. The efficacy doesn't seem to matter whether you use 325 or 162 or 81, but there is a small incremental bleed risk if you go up. And again, there are just a few exceptions to where anyone should be on more than an 81 anyway.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm just thinking maybe now from a community pharmacist perspective where you maybe don't have the full perspective of the patient's history. Mm-hmm. Is there, in that situation, is there ever a time when you would recommend to a patient that they get aspirin?
I think the less full of the profile and details you knew, the less that probably ought to be something that you do. And so if you are talking to a patient in a community setting and there's this debate about it, then I would recommend that they speak with their either primary care physician or cardiologist, putting their entire clinical picture together. And they do say in this task force report, you know, there ought to be this shared decision making. And that's been a pretty common theme in a variety of recommendations in the last couple of years. Anticoagulation, for stroke prevention and AFib, and a lot of areas are saying we need to have a shared decision process where the patient is completely made aware of the risks and the benefits, and then is part of, well, I'm willing to take that risk. Like being on a statin above the age of 70, we know the drug interactions and myopathy risk goes up. So they, the lipid guidelines say that should be a shared decision in people who are getting at that higher risk for side effects.
I'd like to go off topic on that part just for a minute. So that shared clinical decision making, I see it more and more too. It's in immunization guidelines as well. I just want to get your perspective. What do you think the pharmacist's role is in that decision making? Can they be that person, or is it really dependent on the question?
I think it must be dependent on the question and how much data you have to have it to be a fully informed patient. But there are parts that the pharmacist can play a role in understanding what are current guidelines saying, so you understand as a patient what that means. And drug efficacy, drug safety, drug interaction potential, you know, I mean, that's our bailiwick. That's what we should be the best at. And so in a perfect world, you would be part of the triangle between either the primary care physician or cardiologist, the pharmacist, and the patient, and that gets at this multidisciplinary approach to patient care, which you also see now mentioned a lot in a lot of the guidelines that are out there.
Yeah, it's definitely an ideal, and I hope we continue to progress that way. Absolutely.
I do have one bonus question that we didn't prepare you for,
okay. But
does any of this information you've been sharing with us today, does it change anything that we do for people who have already had an event? So we were talking about primary prevention throughout the discussion today, but people who have had an event, does it change any of what we're doing at this point for them?
Yeah, absolutely not. You know, I just taught today, actually, in our program, chronic stable angina. And of all the things you can give to a patient with angina that would reduce their chance for a heart attack in the future, it's not nitroglycerin, and it's not a beta blocker, and it's not a calcium channel blocker or ranolazine. It's aspirin. Right, and then post MI, you get evaluated on how well you manage post MI drug therapy at discharge. And certainly, aspirin and now dual antiplatelet therapy with aspirin is part of that as well. So, it hasn't diminished and shouldn't diminish the enthusiasm for the proper role for aspirin, where the benefits are such that you do take that same bleed risk.
That's good to know, because I could see somebody's looking at a profile at, say, a Walgreens where I currently work and thinking, people shouldn't be on aspirin routine anymore. And that's not true. There are people that it is still appropriate to be on routine aspirin.
Absolutely. And I'll throw in a bonus, too. there's a sort of a CAF conference going on right now. And I get newsletter-like emails that keep me sort of up to date with what's going on. And there was a study, I think, I don't remember what country it was out of, that was presented at this meeting yesterday. And virtually everybody, on dual antiplatelet therapy, which is typically aspirin and clopidogrel, using some non-invasive technique for evaluating erosions in the stomach. I don't know much about that technique because I haven't read the article. There was an accompanying article that I haven't read yet in one of the cardiology journals. 95-97% of people on dual antiplatelet therapy had evidence of stomach erosions, not necessarily bleeding. So the commentary on this is, if you're on dual antiplatelet therapy, whether you have a history of GI bleed or not, you probably ought to just automatically put them on a PPI for the duration of their dual antiplatelet therapy. So that would be a change in what standard practice is right now.
Yeah, that would affect millions of people, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. PPI people will be excited.
See, the problem with PPIs now is that insurance probably isn't going to pay for a lot of prescription PPI when they can download it to the over-the-counter purchase. Yeah. 6 months of PPI is over-the-counter is probably not inexpensive.
No, not at all. Yeah, that's still a pretty penny, so that'll be interesting to see how that unfolds.
See if that evolves into being basically a standard of care in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike, thanks so much for taking the time. I learned a lot, and I really just enjoyed the conversation, so thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you all for joining us for this episode of the Pharmacy Preceptor Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please like or subscribe. We would love your feedback on topics that interest you and how we can make this podcast better. Please submit your comments to help us develop content that best serves you. Thanks, everyone.